The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 239 for Friday, 6th of August, 2010. My name is Jim Race. I'm here in California. With me, on and off, but as always and welcome, is Martin Darlington in the UK. Good evening, Martin.
Hi, Jim. Yeah, good, afternoon, I guess, there. Doing very well and really enjoyed the weekend's racing at Silverstone. Unfortunately, I couldn't attend, but looking forward to talking about that.
Yeah, you were
and doing the show.
You were getting interrupted. It's the hazards of working in the air ambulance service. People fall down all the time, don't they?
Oh, yeah. I know. I could have set my clock. For race one, 15 minutes in, bell goes. came back, thinking I'd have missed most of the World Supersport, but because of the delayed start, managed to get all of that. World Superbike race two, 15 minutes in, bell goes. I'm like, thank you very much. But no, it was a good day for us, and I got back and I was able to. It was really weird, actually. I watched it on the Eurosport. I'm subscribed to Eurosport, and I watched it on their video on demand, but there's no commentary. It's like, oh, this is really spooky.
Sometimes that's kind of nice. I really appreciated for a while watching the MotoGP practices. In the early ones, they still do this when there isn't any commentary, because it really gives you an opportunity to hear the bike sounds and whatnot. I did notice.
Yeah, it's strange. I remember Bob and Jules discussing this good few years ago. And Jules was saying, and I've got to admit, I agree with him. In some ways, he'd rather listen to the commentary and not be able to see than the other way around. It was, when you're there, it's different. But it was like the bad bits of being there, i.e. not really knowing what's going on, what the background and the colouring in bits are. But with the bad bits of watching on telly, you're not there.
Yeah.
So you haven't got the atmosphere. It was strange.
It's very true. I was having a conversation yesterday with somebody about this, how when you go to the track, you don't necessarily encompass everything like you do on TV. And they're two completely different experiences. Those of you that, you know, just listen to the show and watch this on or watch the races on TV, I highly encourage you to get out to a race any way that you can, because it's a completely different experience. It really isn't anything like watching it on TV, and it's certainly not like hearing it from people like us. It is all-encompassing, and it engages all your senses at once. And just go. If you haven't been in a while, go. It changes all the time.
And the thing I find is as long as you can see a big screen, you'll know the important things that happen out of sight to where you actually are. But you see so much more that never gets shown on TV.
Sure.
You know, you see the mid-table and the back of the pack battles going on, and, you know, the little gesticulations from the riders, thinking of Alex Espargaro flipping the bird to Casey Stoner at Catalunya, which was just great. But, yeah.
It really is different. And the opportunity to, you know, it essentially, I've always told people about races, is that I look at a race weekend as an entire experience when I'm attending. And the race weekend for me is defined from the moment I get there, which is usually really early. Like Laguna, I got there basically 1:30 o'clock in the morning on Thursday morning, and I didn't get out of there until Monday night. The same thing is going to be with Indy. I'm going to be getting there really early, because a lot of the things that happen on, say, Wednesday and Thursday in the paddock are things that are very much of interest to you folks, the listeners. But we carry on. I do have a couple of thanks this week. Nigel Creaser and Peter Newell, thank you very much for the donations. Some stickers did go out this weekend. I have put a bunch of additional stickers on order, but I might have to make some changes to them. So stand by if you have not received yours. You will definitely be getting some, and probably even a larger packet. What have we got going on this week? We've got a couple of interviews, which is very cool, after the Silverstone races. We've got one that I did with Miller Motorsports Park. They organize these conference calls. Some of you may have already read the transcript of this online. It has made the rounds, and you'll see my name in there. But with Johnny Ray. And it was very interesting. But the one thing that I really like about it beyond the transcripts is you can hear the passion and emotion in somebody's voice. And that's what I really love about doing this show. Print is neat, but the spoken word really brings across an awful lot more. And so I've really enjoyed doing that. Did it with four or five other journos, including David Emmett of Moto Matters. And then I had a brief call after that. I'm like, who do I want to get on? And out of the blue, I rang up Leon Haslam, and he was doing a chat show up in the north in the UK. And I got just a very quick 5-6 minute conversation with him, kind of recounting what happened over the weekend. And so we've just got a pair, just have two interviews this week.
Well, after last week.
I really have to wonder, because it was funny, we didn't get that many emails this week, and I was wondering if we overloaded you guys last week with so much information, or maybe we just answered all the questions. I doubt that. But keep your cards and letters coming. We're always ready. We did get one. You were talking to Ed Hauser. Fill me in on that one.
Yeah, Ed sent me an email just saying that on the 18th and 19th of September, there is the Assen Centenary Celebration Race Meet. Basically, Assen, the Cathedral of Speed, although some people have suggested since it was neutered, it's more like a Methodist Chapel of Speed. but it's still an amazing place. I went last year, and it really is a brilliant atmosphere there. And they're going to feature races with every class that's ever raced there. So you've got sidecars, you've got 1920s classic bikes. But you look through the rider list, and you've got Freddie Spencer, Christian Seron. And I was reading through these names and thinking, this is taking me back to when I was a teenager and a young lad, just gawping at these guys, thinking, how do they do what they do? And they've got Giacomo Agostini as well, as an entered rider. Several of them are doing several races. You read through the names, and I don't recognize many of them, but there are some you just think, I can't remember what he looks like or where I saw him, but it's a name that just brings back. You know, almost when you get... It's more of an atmosphere than a specific memory or a smell or a feeling for a time. You just think, oh, wow.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
brilliant.
That's a very, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. There's a feeling I get when I descend into like a place like Laguna, which is basically dropping into a bowl, and I just get this weird feeling. And those of you that are massive road racing aficionados will know exactly what I'm talking about. Whenever you visit a race circuit, you can actually maybe hear bikes on course already. And it was even more intense back in the days when we had two strokes, because someplace like Laguna, you'd drop in and the whole place would be filled with this blue haze from, castor oil lingering on the breeze. And it basically puts you in the mindset that you have for that weekend. Anyway, I wouldn't be surprised if... Giacomo wasn't running like every class except for maybe sidecars there.
Yeah.
But thanks, Ed, for that. Appreciate it. Run us through the news. There's a whole bunch of news, and we'll chat about that as we go along.
Yeah, this is something that's been mooted more and more recently. Colin Edwards talking about being more likely to move to Xerox Ducati World Superbikes. Speaking exclusively to MCN, according to MCN, he said, I kind of get this. He said, I don't want to finish my career being angry all the time. I want to have some fun and win some races, or at least have the chance to do that. The motivation to finish eighth or sixth doesn't really interest me. And I kind of get that. You know, he's been often the best of the rest in the MotoGP paddock, but he's still not won a race, even though we all know that Assen, speaking of Assen, he really should have done. Just dreadfully unlucky. Donington... Was it last year when Dovi won his first? I did think Colin might catch him, but, you know, I kind of get it. And he must be looking at Max and Carlos Checa and Troy Caution thinking, I'm a few years younger than them. You know, I mean, Max is looking, definitely, if you went to a bookmaker, you're going to get odds that Max is going to be the favourite to win this year's World Superbike Championship. Although now Leon's been on the show, he's obviously going to do a double win at Nürburgring. And I hope that doesn't put the markers on Leon.
Well, that we've had Johnny on, we're really boiling up the battle at the front, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, hopefully we'll see Leon and Johnny doing what Cal and Johnny did this weekend. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, obviously, Colin, who's he going to replace question is, well, which seat will he get? Because he could probably have the choice of either Fabrizio's or Norihaga's, unfortunately. But that's... I think Tech Toir might well be looking for two new riders next year because Colin's gone out of the series and Ben's moved up.
I agree. So, Colin, really it seems like he's only been mad this year, but I do wish him the best, and we'll have to see where that lands. You were talking a bit about Dovi, and I agree with you on this, and roll with it, and we'll chat about it a bit.
Yeah, I feel gutted for him. Dovi's future is continuing to be rather cloudy. HRC looks like they're unable to fund the three-rider super team idea with Dovi, Casey, and Danny because talks with Red Bull have collapsed. And due to Dovi's contract, which they gave him, which says, supposedly, it says if you finish in the top five, you nailed on for a factory ride in 2011. And yet now they've obviously put this big effort in to get Casey across. I wonder if they may either say, Dovey, Danny, whichever one comes top stays HRC, whichever one of you two comes behind, irrespective, ironically, of where Casey comes on his Ducati, you're going to go to Gresini, but with full factory support. Whether that satisfies the clauses in the contract, I don't know. But
you know, it is still early days at this point, and there's the opportunity for an awful lot to happen as far as sponsorship goes between now and, you know, basically the start of next year. Think about how many additional sponsors, small and large, came on teams over the last couple of years at the last minute. It's been kind of a mix if you think about it. Well, ones that have come and some that have disappeared. I think a lot is going to change, and a lot is very dependent upon what happens with the economy in between the end of the season and the start of next season.
Yeah, I mean, we've just had in the UK, we've had a load of banks announcing their half-yearly profits, and yeah, funny old thing, they're the ones who caused it all, and they seem to be doing rather well out of it. So hopefully that's fairly positive signs of a slow and steady recovery starting. But interestingly, there's been talk that Hervé Poncharal has said that Simone Battistella, who's Dovi's manager, had approached Tectoire just to sound out the possibilities of a move. And Hervé said, yeah, very keen, but only if HRC continue to pay Dovi's wages in a kind of loan deal. And I thought, well, you get that in football, soccer, as it were, to the people across the pond. But I can't see HRC paying the wages of a rider who's going to be riding for a rival manufacturer. And I certainly don't know if this has ever happened before. Yeah, I can't see that one really happening.
Yeah, that would be astounding. You know, I can't remember when or if it has. And if it has, it hasn't been in recent memory. Again, we're going to have to sound things out as time goes on. There's so much, it's incredible. There is so much maneuvering going on behind the scenes right now. And a lot of it's not even that far behind the scenes. And it's one of the reasons why you get a lot of speculation and whatnot in the press right now, is because people hear a whisper and they turn it into a story. And there are an awful lot of whispers going on. The stuff that you would hear if you were even close to some of the back areas of the paddock when I was at Laguna, you know, they would spark off all these ideas in your mind. You just kind of have to tamp them down a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. But of course, I mean, thinking of Tectoire, if Colin were to go to World Superbikes and Ben were to move up to the Fiat Yamaha team or whatever the sponsor will be if Rossi does go to Ducati, which apparently we'll all know after the Brno round, which is, goodness me, that's only a week away.
Indeed.
Hervé could be looking for two new riders, and I can't see him promoting De Rosa from Moto2. So, yeah, I mean, certainly there could well be opportunities for people to get in there, and that's going to be interesting to see. But I guess we're all waiting to hear the confirmation of what everyone thinks is a done deal, that yes, Rossi's going to Ducati, and then everything else will start to fall into place.
I've actually found that in my mind, at least, it's much more comfortable if you assume that's going to happen, and you assume Fiat's going with him, and then it's much easier to start moving.
Start to think about the Telefonica Yamaha team or the Movistar team.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, basically, that move's already been made, and that rook's over here, and I can start moving the rest of my pieces around while you all try and figure out if that rook's actually going to go over there.
Well, the theory I've heard is that Yamaha, because they're a major sponsor of the Laguna Seca round, did a deal with Ducati. They said, look, don't announce it till after Laguna Seca, so he's still a Yamaha rider and we can have all the kudos. You know, obviously they can't stop the speculation. And in return, as soon as we finish the Valencia, we'll release him to go and test early. And allegedly Ducati have also said to Honda, as soon as the season finishes at Valencia, you can have Casey. And yes, you can ride a Honda.
That's actually changed immensely over the last few years, because it used to be, especially if it was an acrimonious split, that sometimes the teams would actually hang on to them until the absolute end of the contract, you know, December 31st or whatnot, and sometimes these guys would get no testing in. It seems like there's been a bit more cooperation. I wonder if that doesn't come through order or just necessity of riders needing, you know, basically putting on a good show. And
yeah, well, witness, you know, and Rossi went to Yamaha. I mean, Honda were absolutely adamant. No, he's not going anywhere. But of course, they didn't have the testing restrictions there. So now, I guess it's even more important
absolutely
that they do what needs to be done as early as possible in terms of getting used to their new bike.
Sure. Yep. I mean, after all, it is sport, but it's also entertainment, and it is also a rather dangerous occupation, and it's always much better for everybody involved if the riders have a chance. You know, we almost talked about this last week, Martin.
Yeah.
But we didn't quite have confirmation, and in fact, I got in touch with the team principal or one of the team principals for one young Elena Myers, who was racing at Laguna Seca. And while she was there, she had the opportunity to go to the Rizla Suzuki garage and have a seat on the bike and kind of feel it out. And she's a relatively small framed person, but not Danny Pedrosa small frame. Mm-hmm. But she's a real racer's racer and very serious. And I've talked to her over the years, and I think I mentioned that here. But apparently she didn't necessarily impress them enough, but they appreciate the opportunity to have her ride at Valencia on the, you know, Journo Press Day. Journo Press / old racers. Don't really mean that wrong, James, and the rest of you out there that get to ride on the Monday. But she's got the opportunity to ride the bike out there, and I think that's pretty cool for her. There's a lot of people, they're, you know, like, oh, she's getting a tryout. No, this is a sort of just a chance to get a hand and feats on a real MotoGP bike.
And yeah,
that's very cool, and I think that's good at Suzuki. I think a lot of that comes through Suzuki, so excellent.
Yeah, I mean, I think when last time that Elena's name came up on the show, you know, I said I think it's a very much a double-edged sword. She's female. She's obviously very talented. She is photogenic, you know, and that's got to open doors. But once the doors opened, the same press attention that will open those doors is going to mean that the pressure on her to be better than an equivalent male rider is going to be enormous.
You know what? I don't think she cares. Those of you that do have a subscription to MotoGP.com, there is a video on there that was done from Laguna Seca. They did about a 3 or 4 minute piece interviewing her in the paddock. And it's pretty telling. And you can actually tell that I don't think she cares. I think she looks she looks at herself as a rider, which is great. And that's exactly what she needs to do. So yeah, good on her. Very, very cool.
Yeah.
What's the big word? This is the one that's kind of been boiling all week, and I love this. I love this in a couple of different ways, and I also think it's a bit wrong in a few others. This is what I'm talking about is the whole Aprilia gear-driven cams thing, and boy, people across the board either come up on this on one side or another. There was a pronouncement by the FIM this week that the gear-driven cam kit was no longer going to be allowed to be used next year. Well, what does that mean and what are the implications? According to Aprilia, they had approached Dorna earlier this year and asked them if it was okay if they used the kit itself. It is a rather expensive kit, and I believe the quoted terms, and I'm not sure if these are accurate, were £25,000 UK.
Ouch.
Yes. Now, and then there were people saying, oh, what does that entail, you know, changing the cases, the heads, et cetera? No, it doesn't. The engine itself was designed with Bosses to accept this kit in placement of the chain and gear-driven kit that comes as standard on the factory model. So basically what you do is you take this apparently expensive semi-unobtainium and you bolt it into the bike and some changes and you're good to go. That's a very simplistic way of putting it, obviously, but they are expensive, and I believe that is the reason that they've actually said that they cannot use them for next year. They're basically double the price of the bike itself in a production model or the factory R model. Is that right? You know, Aprilia asked, and they said, yes, you can use them. Aprilia picked up a couple of horsepower and appeared to be appreciably quicker, and they said, no.
Yeah. I mean, this seems to be, I mean, there's a whole raft of new regulations. Injectors have to be stock.
Yeah.
There's a new minimum weight limit for the two twins and the fours. The method of cam drive must remain as homologated. You know, some of the teams use high-pressure fuel systems and aftermarket injectors, but that's going to be reduced. And as we've mentioned, the gear-driven cam motor. Interestingly, the biggest winners apparently are going to be Honda and Suzuki, who already use standard airboxes and fuel injectors. Everybody is going to benefit because there's an increase in the weight of the bikes. It will be between 165 and 167 kilograms, which is what, a 5 kilogram increase, I think, or a three or four kilogram increase. Doesn't sound a lot, but I guess every little helps when they're struggling like that.
Well,
but,
I think a key part of it is also perhaps a kind of sly attempt to help keep Ducati competitive, because it is becoming more and more clear as time goes on that that engine configuration is not near end of life, but it's been worked on to the point where they may not be able to eke much more out of it. And thus becomes a concern not only for Ducati and Factory Corsa, but for the series, because what was the term that I think James used it when I talked with him last week? It's something like headliner or something. I mean, Ducati and World Superbike are kind of synonymous with each other, and it's a premier team. Whether or not you like that is irrelevant, frankly. The fact is that we need a lot of bikes on the grid. So are a lot of rule changes great? No. We here, at least myself, never like it.
No.
Will it help the sport itself maintain longevity and interest by the public? One hopes so. But it's the arbitrary rule changes that really kill people like me.
I remember Bob making a very, very valid point that a cost-cutting rule change
only cuts
costs if it's implemented and kept for a number of years.
Right.
You know, I mean, all the development they've had to do to get longevity out of the engines for this year will only pay benefits if that rule stays in for 5 or 6 years. But Dorna, and you've got to say in World Superbikes, they seem to be doing the same, they're chasing their tails.
Yep.
It seems to be a constant case of, well, that didn't work, let's change it again. No, it may not have worked initially because it takes people time to bed in and get used to it and develop. Don't blooming change it as a knee-jerk reaction. It's crisis management all the time.
Well, I think the most important thing is, and Infront didn't do this, but we did see this with the, not necessarily the switch to 800s, but the massive restrictions we had this year on engines, was do not make drastic changes. Drastic changes are the ones that, in the end, will come back and bite you when you have to make a decision as the season goes on and essentially reverse yourself, as we've been seeing. And I haven't heard a whole lot more, but of course, I'm sure there's tons and tons of conversation going on about additional engines for various MotoGP teams this year. And so we'll have to see where that goes. But boy, we could linger on the news forever, and we haven't even got to the race, have we, Martin? Oh, there's one last thing I do want to talk about.
Absolutely.
Randy Dipugne continues to heal well following the Valentino Rossi prescription of hyperbaric chambers and all sorts of exercise. And he says he's good to go for Brno. Now, the conversation you might remember from a week and a half ago, or almost 2 weeks ago now, that I had with Lucio Ciccanello, he was also positive about Randy's progress. And here we are 2 weeks later, and Randy sounds even better. He's going to be meeting with Dr. Costa of the Clinica Mobile next Thursday at Brno and see if he can get certified to race. We did see some pictures of his leg that, whilst not pretty, looked to be healing fairly well. And so we'll have to see, right?
Yeah, yep. I mean, it's a long bone break, isn't it? So I guess if they can come back from anything, I would imagine, not having had a huge amount of broken leg injuries, I've had one early in my youth playing football, it's just a question for Randy of, you know, can he stand the pain?
Mm-hmm.
And if he has a pain-killing injection, does he still have enough function left, allowing for that element of numbness to be able to work on it? Bearing in mind, it's his left foot and it's his gear change foot.
Yeah.
Or it's his left leg, sorry.
Well, and then he also has a tibia strain on his right foot. So he's certainly got things to overcome. And as he said in an interview yesterday, he's using his crutches less and less. Well, that doesn't necessarily sound good until you realized that, you know, Rossi was still using his crutches at Laguna Seca, although to a lesser degree. So, we'll see. You know, it's a week away.
I did like his comment, I'm training my upper body with rubber bands and special exercises. And Sharon, who's a particular fan of Randy Dipugne, who I suspect a lot of the ladies are, she said, oh, sounds kinky. What is it he does with rubber bands and special exercises? But probably best leave that to people's imaginations.
Yes,
or not.
Completely digressing from the intent of the show, but I do know we've some female listeners out there, and although you never write in, I can't remember the last time that we actually had a woman write in to us. If there is one out there, take the step. Come on.
If Grace from the F1 pod's listening, I'm sure Grace will be able to say, yep, I still watch Randy. She's probably very, very disappointed that he's been as successful as he is because she doesn't get to see those great shots of him with his unzipped leathers sat in the pit.
And that is the content for...
Yep.
All right, let's get on to... that's funny.
Good morning, everyone. Sorry for the delay. I'm John Gardner. I'm the media manager at Miller Motorsports Park. And as you know, we've been doing a series of interviews this year with riders in the Hans Spree Superbike World Championship. This week, it is our pleasure to have Jonathan Ray, who rides number 65 Honda CBR 1000RR for Hans Spree Tenkata Racing. He comes off a very strong weekend at his home track in Silverstone, where he qualified second and finished second in both races. So, Jonathan, well.
Hi there, guys.
So, a good weekend for you. Maybe not quite as good as you would have liked, but not bad regardless. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I'm going to Silverstone and coming off the back of a 1-2 in Czech Republic. I was really looking forward to the race, and the circuit was new. It was a new layout, so it was quite cool to ride there. And, you know, both races, I gave everything I had, but to be honest, you know, there's another guy out there a little bit stronger, so we failed to get the wins that we were looking for.
You're third in the championship. It's your second year in the series. You're doing really well. Are you satisfied with your progress? Is this kind of what you thought it would be like, or better or worse, or what?
To be honest, I thought it might go a little bit better, but we've run into some inconsistencies with our bike, and, you know, some circuits it's working very well, some circuits it's not, so... Right now, I thought we'd be fighting for the championship title, but it's at this moment in time, it's not the case. So, it's been a little bit under par for me.
You've been here to Miller Motorsports Park twice. The first year you came here, you were fifth and third in the two races, and then this year you didn't have such a good year. You were 14th and 8th. Tell me what you think about our facility here and how it compares to some of the other tracks you race on.
Yeah, the facility is great, to be honest, but... As you can imagine, I didn't have a lot of good things to say about my race there this year. And, you know, Pirelli, they came up with some new tires. And, you know, it's just created some problems with our bike at certain circuits. And with the fast flow nature of the circuit there, with a lot of bumps, it created a lot of chatter problems for us. So it wasn't great results-wise, but, you know, I love getting out there. Not just the facility, it's good that I think it's one of the best circuits in America. But then again, you know, it's nice to go, and the overseas race creates a bit of a holiday feel for all the European teams and riders. And, you know, not just the facility there, but the town itself is very accommodating, and, you know, the people are pretty cool as well.
And our first question comes from Jim from MotoGPOD.
MotoGPOD, that'll work. Thank you very much. Jonathan, welcome, and must have been a bit of a fairy tale weekend for the Brits out there.
Yeah, it's cool. You know, there's so many British fans. I think we had two full podiums, but even the second race, I think, was a top five. But, you know, I had my hands full racing Cal Crutchlow in both races, and I kind of forgot about the rest. But nice to get home in front of all the home people and see pretty much a lot of friendly faces around.
Indeed, and across the board. There are a few tracks that are like this on the World Superbike calendar. Do you think Silverstone, the new Silverstone, might be one of those tracks that you don't necessarily want to be leading the last lap on?
For me, it didn't really matter. I was thinking during the race, you know, going into the very last corner, there was a big screen, and, you know, I could see that Cal was pretty much welded to my bumper the whole race. And, you know, I know if you're pretty spot on there with hitting your apex, if somebody comes past, they're going to run wide. And I knew if he was going to come past, there would be a chance of getting back past. But, you know, the bike was producing a little bit more grip when the tires dropped. And, you know, it was pretty effortless for him to get past me and drive on.
All right. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Jim from Superbike Planet.
Hey, Jonathan. Hey, Jonathan. How you doing, man?
Hi, not so bad. I'm good.
All right, so you mentioned that the new tires have kind of given you an issue with the bike at some of the circuits. Leon Haslam said the same thing. I think he mentioned something about there being better edge grip on the new tires, and that's created the chatter problems. Is that what you're experiencing with the new Pirellis on your bike at some of the circuits, or what's the problem? What seems to be the issue with the tire the new tires?
Yeah, well, basically Pirelli, let's just call it a banker. The code is 625, but that being our banker tire, we know works pretty much anywhere. Throughout the year, Pirelli hosts some tests where the official teams are invited to test new prototype tires. From these tests, you know, during the season, there was some new generation tires that arrived. Salt Lake City, Misano for sure was the prototype tire. And my feeling, I think a lot of other riders' feelings, is there's a lot of inconsistencies with the new tires, but also they're really upsetting our bike as well. In Silverstone and in Brno, we reverted back to the 625 that was so popular. It's the banger tie, you know. We know it works, and yeah, it was pretty good.
Well, are you so? What seems to be the problem? Are you just getting so much grip now that it's creating chatter problems, or what do you think the issue is with the tire?
Well, for me, I think it's a lot more than just the tire. We can't just blame the tire. You know, our bike was a little bit inconsistent as well. I think when it just didn't work. You know, in Misano, in Salt Lake, coming out of Turn 1, I had horrendous rear chatter. Caused two crashes on myself. Not slides, but just chattering around in the rear. And, you know, it really upset my confidence. From the data, my guys were, you know, they couldn't believe what they were seeing and how bad it was in Misano. As much as it wasn't as bad as what it was in Salt Lake City, it was still there. And that was really affecting my confidence because I couldn't push to the maximum. And, you know, the common denominator was, you know, these new generation tires. And that's what we kind of drew our conclusions to. And now that we've reverted back, we're getting a more comfortable ride. And, you know, I can push a lot harder.
One of the things that was kind of shocking about the race over the weekend at Silverstone was typically in World... Like the results are much tighter. It's much closer racing, unlike MotoGP, where they talk about, you know, the aliens being out in front of the rest of the grid. This is, you know, over the weekend, you and Cal certainly seem like aliens amongst the World Superbike riders. Why do you think you two ended up being so far ahead of everybody else? Was it just that, you know, you were on home turf and so you dug a little bit deeper, or you were pushing each other? I mean, it was pretty incredible to see a World Superbike race that where two guys really just took off and left everybody behind. What do you think that was down to?
Yeah, you know, I really think that's crap, being home race and you push harder. I mean, how does somebody push harder because they're at home? And doesn't say a lot for them at other circuits, but I don't know. My game plan to go there was, you know, I want to win. I always want to win. I always give my best. So free practice one, I went out, tried to get through the circuit, try to pick lines, not rush too much. And, you know, I found after the first session that I enjoyed the track. And clearly all weekend, Cal was going to be my main opposition. I also thought Michel Fabrizio looked pretty good on paper, but... you know, come the race, I actually figured there'd be a couple more guys there, and there wasn't, which surprised me. And, you know, normally the night before the race, I sit down with my data guys and my crew chief, and we figure out, you know, who's strong, and we're looking at things. And, you know, Cal's been unbelievable at throwing these laps in. You know, he's had so many pole positions. We didn't know whether he would figure in our plan or not, whether he could put it together. And, you know, he turned up, and, you know, he brought his A game, and he was there for all 18 laps, and, you know, a bit of a surprise for everybody, but, you know, it clicked for him, and, you know, it was nice to have a little bit of a race. You know, I gave him as good as I had, and, you know, we came off second.
Thanks, man. I'll hand it over to somebody else now. Thanks, John.
Cheers.
And our next question comes from Paul from the Motor World.
Morning, Jonathan. How's it going?
It's not so bad.
Wonderful. Where are you, by the way, right now?
I'm back on the Isle of Man, a little tiny island in between Ireland and the UK.
It's a wonderfully famous place.
Yeah.
Well, my questions are a little bit different so much. Our program focuses on people. Oh, by the way, also, congratulations on the second place and third place at Suzuka. How was Suzuka?
Suzuka was absolutely awesome. You know, one of the highlights in my career so far. I love the circuit. You know, I rode for a great team out there. I had a good teammate. And the buzz of, you know, not just being new out in the circuit, but all the other things put together was just really, really cool. Cool to do something different.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. Well, congratulations on that. Well, like I was starting to say, our program focuses more on personality sort of stuff. So my listeners like to learn about you so much. So if you don't mind, ask us some questions about, like, your history. Like, how old were you when you got started right when you first rode a motorcycle?
Well, my birthday is in February, and I rode a bike Christmas before my third birthday, and it was a Telejet 50, and my father kind of ran behind me for a little bit, and then when I got the hang of it, he just pushed me off, and you know, I rode a little 50cc motocross bike before I rode a bicycle without stabilizers, and you know, that was my introduction.
Wow, very young. Now, when did you actually start racing, and did you start in the dirt? Did you start on pavement? How did you get started?
Yeah, I started motocrossing when I was 5 years old. I think the minimum age back home. I'm pretty much started winning, you know, the 50cc and 60cc championships straight away, amateur level. And back home in Ireland, the competition was dwelling out. So most weekends, my family and I would make the trip to England. You know, it's a little short boat journey, 2 hours, and travel throughout the UK and find, you know, hot competition. And, you know, that was my life from, you know, about 9 years old until I was 15. And then there was this...
Is 15 when you switched over to road racing?
Yeah, there was actually an advert in the motorcycle newspaper. It's quite a big weekly paper here, and they were looking for a young up-and-coming rider to fill the Red Bull Rookies program. It's a 125 team in the UK, and you know, to be honest, I didn't want to do it. I wanted to be a professional motocrosser, and you know, my idols are Jeremy McGrath and people like James Stewart, and I kind of thought, I'd much prefer to be them than a Valentino Rossi. And when I got the chance to go on a road bike, you know, I quite liked it. It came quite natural to me. It was a lot easier on my body, and you know, getting this opportunity, was a lot less financial straining on my family. So it was great. And after my first year, there were still doubts whether this was right for me, or you know, things didn't come easy. I was really fast. I had a few crashes, but my second year, Red Bull merged with the official Honda team in the UK to create a super sport bike and a step up to super bike for me as well. And you know, when that stepping stone came, you know, I knew it was for me, and I attacked it. You know, I grabbed it with both hands, and haven't looked back since.
Obviously, so you're doing very well. Now, when you made the switch up to the British Superbike Series on that, how did that come about real quickly?
Well, the second year of my career, I was in a super sport team, and the team was it was the exact same team that ran Colin Edwards and Aaron Slight in 2002 on Castrol Honda. And they, you know, they halfway through the season, I broke my femur. And I thought that was pretty much the end of my dream, you know. And then the team manager came, and he told me he had seen enough that, you know, that I was a little bit, you know, I wasn't a 50 kilo jockey. I was 69 kilos, and you know, super sport, 69, 70 kilos. Super sport really wasn't my direction, the way I was growing. And you know, he thought the plan could be, you know, to, you know, a year in Superbike. And Red Bull got involved with that again for another 2 years, so 5-06. And then 07, HRC were in England developing tires, Michelin tires, and I think for the radar program. And I got the opportunity to ride for the HM Plant Honda team on factory machinery with Kianari as my teammate.
Yes. Okay, then the switch over to Tenkata.
Well, I guess I just didn't have enough, but I was just kind of over riding around some of the UK circuits, you know, and I wanted to be a world champion. And the way, you know, I could stay in BSB and pick up a little paycheck, or you know, I could take a gamble and try to go to the world championship on a promise of, you know, a superbike ride in 2 years. And you know, I just wanted to get out and to race some proper circuits and learn the European way of life. And going back to a super sport bike wasn't something I was scared of. I had a great teammate in Andrew Pitt, an ex-world champion, so I learned quite a lot. The team had a pretty good success rate with their super sport machine, so I went there. Unluckily, I just missed out on the championship in the last few races, but you know, I gave it a good go, finished second, and you know, that my second year of my contract guaranteed a superbike ride, and you know, that's what whet my appetite in the first place for this job. And last year we had a pretty good season.
You had a very good season, and this one's going very well for you too. Let me ask you this last question here, that so we can turn it over to somebody else. I've taken a lot of your time, but what about MotoGP aspirations? Is that your next step?
Oh, I don't know. Big question, eh? I know, you know, over your side of the pond, MotoGP is pretty big. Superbike's not. I just want to ride with the chance of winning races. You know, I don't want to go to that championship and just make up the numbers. And I feel that I still have a lot of proof. Myself as an athlete and as a person, I still have a lot to learn as well, and I don't want to go there and get thrown back into the World Superbike Championship in a year because I haven't made the grade. So I still feel I've got some work to do and to get there, but that's my aim. You know, I said when my dad used to road race, one of my all time heroes was Kevin Swantz. I actually got the chance to meet him not that long ago, and you know, that's MotoGP. From when I was a young age, that was the pinnacle of motorsport, and it's definitely my plan to get there. And I figure in Honda's plans as well in the next 2 years, so we're just waiting to see. And I think I'll know more about my future really in the next few weeks, so I'm looking forward to hearing about that.
Well, thank you so much for your time. It's always exciting to watch you race, and I wish you the best for the rest of this season. But thanks so much for your time today, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Okay, and our next call, our next question comes from John from America Honda.
Hi, Jonathan. How are you doing?
I'm not so bad. I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm very good. It was great to meet you at Miller. Couple of questions for you. Were there three rounds remaining? And obviously you had a great race win in Germany at Nuremberg last year. With the three circuits that are still to come with Imola and Magna Cours, is there one in particular, or just looking forward to everything now that the machine seems to be working pretty well for you?
I'm looking forward to every single one, to be honest. Although we have to go into races now with an open mind, wondering whether everything's going to work perfect or we're going to have big problems. I know, you know, Misano last year I won races, but this year I struggled a lot. But I really enjoy all three circuits coming up. I had a win last year in Nürburgring, and, you know, Imola had great pace, but, you know, just was unlucky with situations I was put in. And Magna Cours, I had a podium and a mechanical. So
yeah,
I'm looking forward to finishing off the year strong, and I'm really motivated to keep us on the podium.
That sounds great. One other quick question about Suzuka. Obviously, as a Honda-owned circuit, that, and you already talked about some of the what that was like. Was there anything that surprised you or that you found the most interesting just about either the race or the weekend or the atmosphere, or is there anything else about that really, really stood out for you at Suzuka?
Nothing. I've been there and done it before, so nothing really surprised me. But the nicest, the best thing was, you know, the people there are just so friendly and so, they've got so much manners. You know, everyone in the morning says hello, whether it be in the hotel or at the racetrack, and they're so passionate about their racing. Where World Championship, I might have 10 people in the garage, and in Japan in the TSR Honda team, we had about 45 people in the garage running around after you. And you know, I felt really appreciated. They looked after me really well, and you know, I think that's just Japanese culture. They're great people, and you know, it's, like I said before, I just really love the event as a whole.
That sounds good. Well, one last thing. I can tell you have a tremendous amount of fans here in America and with Honda, and you kind of represent a little, and we're certainly very much hoping that you'll be staying a member of the Honda family, because we love watching you racing, and we wish you every success.
Thanks very much, John.
Thank you.
Okay, our next question comes from Jim Race from MotoGPOD.
Hey, Jonathan. John did just touch on the rest of the season. You've got six races left. You're kind of in a bit of a no man's land, though, in a way. With you got 70 up to Leon, and you've got Checa back with 39. And you are heading to Nürburgring next, where you had, I believe, a fourth and a win last year. What are your goals for the rest of the year? Plug away?
I'd like to be second. Max is way too far in front to think about a win, but, you know, 70 points in three rounds isn't, it's been done before. You know, I lost a potential 50 in Monza, so I'm not sure. It's I want to win races for sure. I want to be on the podium every weekend, and I want to remain healthy and really enjoy my race. And I've enjoyed the last two races a lot, and you know, hopefully I can keep doing that and keep banging in the results.
Absolutely, absolutely. And kind of a lighter note, I really have to ask, how difficult is it to cheer on your mate Eugene in Supersport while you're sitting next to your boss in the 10-car garage?
See, how do you know I was cheering on Eugene? No, to be honest, Eugene's a great friend of mine, and I was, you know, I didn't care really who won the race. I was watching the race from a point of view of, you know, trying to learn some more paths and places for my next race. And you know, Supersport always throws up a great race. There's some time to kill in the day. So, you know, I was sat there and it was a great race. I kind of thought when I was I was a little bit pissed off, you know, the camera kept coming to me when I was getting, you know, dwelled in the race. But with five laps to go, it was like the last lap of a 125 GP. It was quite manic. And if I had a microphone, I'd love to tell him just to settle down and fight it out on the last lap. But it was a great race right to the end.
I would have to imagine with the sweep that you guys did of all the podiums, it was a very, very late night on Sunday night.
Sunday night, let me see. Yeah, well, yeah, it did go pretty late, to be honest. You know, all us guys get on pretty well. Everyone just kind of ate. My manager, he's actually American guy, Chuck Axon, went and got us some takeaway McDonald's to be bad. We're going to a 4-week break now, so it's a bit of a holiday time. So I think both myself and Cal and Leon Haslam and even Roger Lee Hayden, they came around my motorhome, we played some cards and, you know, put the words to right. So it was really good fun.
All right, well, I'll let you go. Thanks again for a great weekend, and look forward to seeing what you can do at the ring.
All right, thanks very much.
And we have a follow-up coming from Jim from Superbike Planet.
Hey, man, I'll make it kind of quick because I know you probably got a beach to go to or something, because you must be looking forward to the break, Jonathan. But I wanted to just follow up on your comments about MotoGP and getting on a bike that you can win. It kind of seems like, I mean, with the exception of Ben Spies, historically, a lot of guys end up going from World Superbike into GP and get kind of chewed up and don't always have their expectations met about what they're going to accomplish in the series. One guy that you seem to be pretty close to is Cal Crutchlow, and there's a lot of rumors lately about him going to maybe MotoGP next year if Rossi leaves and Spies replaces him in the factory team. What do you think about the path? And, you know, should you go to MotoGP as soon as you can to learn those bikes? Should you maybe, you think as a rider you'd rather accomplish something significant like winning a World Superbike title before you go to MotoGP? What are your overall thoughts, particularly on the rumors about Cal maybe going to MotoGP?
Well, that's a big can to fill there. MotoGP, it's, like I said before in the conversation, it's the pinnacle of the sport. And to go there, you know, it's swallowed a few Superbike guys up in the past. But then let's not forget as well, everyone's human beings. They talk about these guys being aliens, but, you know, Ben's going to get it right. He's going to be at the front. I rate him highly. I raced him bar to bar last year. And, you know, what's encouraging for me is, you know, I beat him. He's not some sort of, you know, guy that's too far out there to aim towards, and I think he's doing a great job in that championship. You know, Cal, on the other hand, is another great talent. I think, you know, the speed, you know, he has as a rider is unbelievable. I mean, he's still only young, I think 24 or 5. When he finds himself and finds his feet, he's going to be a force. So, you know, I'm 23 years old. I've got time on my side, and you know, I like to accomplish a World Superbike Championship because I do feel I need to deserve to be in that paddock. I don't want to just go there because, you know, something's cropped up or my passport or whatever. And, you know, I want to make a good go of it as well. And, you know, Troy Bayliss, he didn't work out all right for him. And he came back to World Superbike to enjoy himself. And, you know, he proved all the hype about MotoGP by, you know, going and smoking everybody at Valencia. So,
yeah,
you know, as much as you think there's a massive gulf between World Superbike and MotoGP, there's not. You know, it's a motorbike with two wheels and it's human beings with arms and legs. So,
All right, and just one last question. Two guys that kind of were expected at the beginning of the season to be really strong title contenders, James Tozen and Norihaga, have had difficult seasons. I'm just curious about your thoughts banging bars with those guys this year. And are you seeing anything in terms of, you know, what's up with those guys on a competitive level with you out on the track? You know, to viewers and fans, I think it kind of looks like those guys just don't seem to have generally the speed this year. For you as a rider, being out there racing with those guys, how do they feel? How do James and Nori feel to you from a competition standpoint, weekend in, weekend out this year?
Well, you know, I can't slag off any of my rivals.
I'm definitely not asking you to slag them. Just at all.
No, there's, you know, aside from Max Biaggi, who, you know, it's, you know, he hates people saying it, but, you know, nobody's stupid in the world that watches TV, and, you know, that bike he's on so fast compared to everything, and he's one of the older guys at the front. Now, James and Nori, they're, you know, they've been there and done it. And right now there's, you know, there's a whole crop of young guys now that, you know, they're just so hungry for winning. And, you know, I give my best every single weekend. And, you know, sometimes I make mistakes, or, you know, it's the same with Cal, it's the same with Leon. But, you know, James and Nori, they, for sure, I expected James to challenge for the title. He jumped on a championship winning bike, and They were pretty annoyed with the bike that Ben had left them, and they requested a lot of development stuff. And, you know, when they got that, it didn't work either. So, you know, I expected James to be there. The Ducati hadn't, they didn't have much plan for development. I think that bike's as good as it gets. So, to be honest, I think James fell short of my expectations, and, you know, Norris had some bad luck as well. So it's, for sure I didn't expect Leon Haslam to be so far at the front, but I did expect Max to be there, and, you know, James and Noy are about where I thought they'd be anyway.
And your teammate Max Neukirchner, how's things coming along for him? Do you guys have a collaborative relationship in terms of developing the bike and comparing notes, or not? How's that relationship?
Yeah, Max is a great guy, you know, off the bike, and, you know, on the bike he's struggling to find something, you know. I think, you know, judging by even the team press releases and things, sometimes, you know, he finds a way, and then it's the next session it just doesn't work. I really don't know what's going on, and to be honest, I don't pay too much attention. I try to focus on you know, the positive side when we can find something, and there's been a lot of you know, negative vibes from that side of the guys with things not working. I don't want to get too caught up on that, but we Assen's our test circuit, and we use it quite a lot, especially in after the race. We've used it now twice, and we're going back there before Nürburgring for some testing. And, you know, there's been a few times where I've said, you know, Max, I've been following you. Do you want to just click on the back of me and, you know, try and improve your lines? Because it's obviously, you know, I work pretty good around Assen, and I could see straight away from getting on the back of him, he was doing so much wrong. And when he followed me, he would find something. But, you know, it pains me sometimes to see him struggling, because he's such a cool guy and a nice kid. And, you know, I've seen how well he went on the Suzuki as well. But, you know, something just isn't right on that side.
Yeah. All right, man. Thanks so much for the time. And best of luck for the rest of the year, Jonathan.
Cheers, man.
And our next question comes from Ron Lieback from Ultimate Motorcycling. Your line is open.
Hello, John. How are you doing?
I'm good. And you?
You're relaxing on your break?
Yeah. Well, I'm just getting done here and heading out on the motocross bike.
Oh, awesome, man. Awesome. All right. I just got a couple questions for you here. Concerning your doubles at Silverstone, your double podiums, that is, you and Crutchlow are really at it. What do you think were the major, were there any other, like, major issues holding you back besides, like, all the stuff you were talking about with the Pirellis?
At Silverstone, you know, I gave it everything. That was all I had. And it kind of really pained me to see Cal pass me and just, you know, ride away with ease. But in that race, where he was passing me and drawing alongside, the last turn, exit of turn one, they just had, they was working a little bit more on edge grip, their bike, and, you know, when our tire dropped off, I just didn't have any answers, and, you know, fair play to them.
All right. And then in the opening qualifying session, you were second fastest behind Crutchlow. You said you really enjoyed riding the circuit, and I like your quote that you said, it fills me full of happy pills because it's all new and fresh. And you had, obviously, had some good luck on the revamped circuit. Is this now your favorite circuit on the schedule, and what part of the track do you feel most comfortable on?
I don't know. I think, yeah, it's one of my favorites. You know, I try to like all the circuits. You know, Phillip Island's a favorite of mine as well. Bruno, I like fast flowing circuits, and that's something that, Miller Motorsport is, Phillip Island, Silverstone, the Bruno, so many circuits. And the favorite section is actually they're building new garages. I don't know the corner names yet, it's too new, but it's the new pit straight, and you go into a right corner and then it's left. I think it's called Village or Club.
Okay.
But it's a fourth gear corner, and you're pretty much spinning it the whole way around. And, you know, it's one of the coolest corners, I think, in the world. I think Casey Stoner actually came off with the same remark when he raced there.
Nice. All right, and then with the Suzuka 8, taking third, that was very impressive. First, what were the engine troubles you guys were having with the CVR?
Where was that, sorry?
In Suzuka, you guys were having some engine troubles with the bike?
Engine trouble? No, to be honest, the problems we had was in the first stint, my teammate he had a little problem with the starter motor, and the bike didn't start too fast, and he got caught in traffic, and some guy bent his clutch lever right up. Then he passed under two yellow flags, making his way to the front, and I received two ride-through penalties.
Okay.
Then in the second hour, I kicked into a corner underneath a back marker, and it was pretty much all the way through, and the back marker just, he kept on coming back to the corner, and he hit me, he more or less just threw his bike on top of my back tire and picked my front wheel up, and, we went down. We lost five laps, but the best part of the race was, we lapped the leader three times to come back to second, or two laps down at the finish, and to jump on the podium. So definitely one of the best races in my career. I think, every single lap we had was so much faster than everybody else, and it was really enjoyable to have that feeling of never give up. I'd be lying in the plunge pool at the back, the ice bath after my stint, thinking, I can't wait to ride again and make up even more positions. And that's a great job by my teammate and my team as well.
Nice, real nice, huh? Now, do you think you would have positioned yourself a lot better if you guys didn't have any problem with the starter motor or anything? I mean, since you're running so strong.
Yeah, for sure. But I'm not an if, but, or maybe kind of guy.
Yeah.
But receiving the bike with two ride-through penalties to do after passing on the yellow flag, and had he not had a bad start, would he have had to come and pass under yellow flags? I don't know. It's an 8-hour race. It's not about how fast you are. It's about, luck needs to be on your side. But
yeah.
I think we were pretty much the story of the weekend, coming from 42nd and five laps down. And, anybody there and seen the race and seen how fast my teammate was and how we were working together, for sure, if we went back next year and attacked it with a different mindset, then, I'm sure the win could be ours as well.
Nice. So is that one of your goals, to get back there next year also, or?
Well, it really depends on, what contract I have next year. It's that time of year, and if I'm still with Honda, everything's working out great, then, I'd love to go, because I can't, it's just an awesome race, A lot of the guys say that they hate going because it's a pain in the ass and it's too much out of their time frame. But, it was 10 days of my life, and I came back to my next race and, riding on different tires, different suspension. It didn't upset my rhythm at all. And, I got pretty much back into the worst sort of bike way of riding straight away. So it didn't really upset my rhythm too much. And if I got the chance to go again next year with the same team, the same teammate, then for sure I'd do it.
Excellent, excellent. So you, I mean, that was very impressive. But now that you're on break, do you have anything special you're doing? Or are you just going to be on the motocross track a lot or what?
Well, you know, I don't know if you guys get the live feed, but my friend, you maybe see him sitting in the guys sometimes. A guy called Keith Amore comes to all my races, but he's actually, he's like a road racer. Well, you guys call it probably street racing, but specialised in Islandman TT, Northwest 200s, and in 2 weeks' time, he's got a big race at the Ulster Grand Prix, which is it's something like a 4-and-something-minute lap time and an average speed of 132 miles an hour. It's one of the fastest road races in the world, so I'm going to go and help out there. And you know, that's going to include anything from carrying wheel stands to pit board, and it's really good to get back to grassroots and to will him on as well. He takes enough time out of his life to come and help me on a weekend and just be there as a bit of a mentor, so I can repay the favor there. And aside from that, I'm just hanging out, doing normal things, going out to dinner with my girlfriend, going to the cinema, and doing cool things, catching up with my family who I never really see.
All right, excellent. Well, have fun, man. Good luck with the rest of the season.
Thanks, you.
All right, take care.
Hey, and our next question comes from David Emmett from MotorMatters.com. You may ask your question.
Hi, Johnny. I'll keep this short. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. You've given us so much of your time already. I have a quick question about you switched to, about suspension. You switched to Ohlins last year. Do you think that is causing some of the erraticness that you're talking about, and making it so difficult to set the bike up with the new Pirellis, or is it just the tyres themselves?
No, to be honest, I don't think it's got anything to do with the inconsistencies we're experiencing. The WP fork, pre-Ohlins was, it chattered as well. Had the same problems, and I think with the Ohlins was, they're developing a lot more, and every other bike in the paddock seems to be running Ohlins, so to kind of put it down to them wouldn't really be fair on them. I think there's a lot more to it than that, so yeah.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know. Thanks very much.
Let's get on to the fantastic racing that we had this weekend in Silverstone. We ended up with good weather. I was amazed.
I know. Our weather has not been good over here. Some of the practices were wet, and it's just every day. It seems, certainly up in the northwest, it seems to be showering. But no, we were very blessed. And race one, I found quite extraordinary the pace of the leading two. Should we go through the results and then?
Yeah, you know what? Let's just very briefly talk about Super Pole and whatnot. Because there was some interest there, and I'm just going to run through the top eight, the guys that made it through Super Pole 3 from the top of the box. Cal Crutchlow with a blistering lap, and that's been kind of the talk all week. His lap time on that, okay, and granted, it's on a qualifying tire, but we do know that MotoGP was just there. His lap time on his quali in Super Pole 3 would have placed him fifth. On the MotoGP grid.
And he said afterwards, and he was desperate to get into the 203s.
Yeah.
Because he was in the same bracket as MotoGP riders then.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that was a 205. Was it a 205? No.
He did a 2. No, his qualifying was a 204.
That's right.
129 or something, yeah. Or 1, yeah.
But an astounding lap that actually didn't even look that hard. So I was quite impressed. So your top eight that made it through to Super Bowl III, Crutchlow, Ray, Haslam, Fabrizio, Biaggi, Kamir, Cheka, Toesland, and it was nice to see JT up there. There were a lot of people that were looking at him this weekend, and certainly the incessant talk of the British press. Boy, they love JT, don't they?
Oh, bless it, he can't do anything right for doing wrong. They big him up and then seem to take quite a bit of pleasure in saying, oh dear, oh, that didn't go very well, did it? You think, Jesus, well, it's something that we'll probably talk about a bit later about perceptions, which obviously we get a lot of our information from from the motorcycle racing press. And, you know, it's horrible to feel you're being manipulated, but I think we are. But we'll talk about it in more detail later. But, of course, Leon Camus' fast lap was dumped. It was deleted because he, on the entry to the start-finish straight, he drifted wide just onto the AstroTurf. And even though his team said, look, you can see he didn't gain an advantage, he drifted wide. He lost 0.2. They said, nope, fastest time deleted. And he ended up 16th on the grid.
Well, so okay, so for a little bit of reference on that, A, the riders were very specifically told, don't go out there. Secondarily, during the GP practice, the exact same thing happened. People were having their times dropped left and right. So it's not like nobody knew. It essentially, maybe it doesn't give you an advantage, but it is a no man's land.
He did say, he held his hands up and said, no, it was my fault.
Yeah, the alternative would be to put something out there that you would never want to ride on, like some AstroTurf. But instead, it's just green painted concrete.
Yeah.
And so they're giving you a safety margin, but don't go there. And if you do, you're going to be penalized. Now, it was clear from the sector times that that was going to be a fast lap. Was it right? I guess within the letter and spirit of the rules, yeah. They already said. So it didn't really matter in the end. He still got, you know, he still got a good starting position, and there's nothing wrong with second row. It's all up to you at that point. So definitely cool. Let's walk through race one, and we'll touch on a bunch of the highlights, because all of the races this weekend were fantastic.
Well, Johnny Ray was out the box, got the whole shot, started to pull away with Cal glued to him. And Johnny Ray, Cal Crutchlow, basically, fairly quickly, dropped everybody else.
Indeed.
We had Leon was able to pull out. Max had a strange race. He started really, really quick, quickly got knocked about a bit. Now, the interesting thing about race one, Michel Fabrizio, suddenly he's fourth.
Yeah.
He finishes fourth in the race. Didn't do much dramatic, but didn't do anything wrong. Just was able to stick there and plug it away. He was, what, over four seconds behind Leon at the end, but just a second and a half ahead of Max.
Yeah, I should pop look at a lap chart, because he kind of did... He didn't necessarily appear out of nowhere, but he wasn't anything that you had on your radar. And to be true, the focus was certainly on the guys at the front, because that was a great battle. And the stuff that was going on back in the second group was, if you will, a bit processional. Leon had, for quite some time, a halfway decent lead over the second group. He was in a bit of no man's land. And so it was essentially the third group, if you will. And the cameras weren't focusing on that much of all, only every so often. So I really should, well, I won't do it for this show, but I'll try and do that for the next show when we have a situation like that. Because it is kind of interesting when somebody kind of just pops up and you're like, wait a minute, where'd they come from?
What did upset a number of people was the very quickly disseminated knowledge reported on Eurosport by Jack and James that Leon Camier had overtaken Max and then given the place back. Team orders or just a suggestion?
We know it was team orders because they threw out a board that had not even very cryptic. It had one word on it and it said switch.
Oh, right. I missed that.
Yeah.
I missed that. Yeah.
And so that's pretty plain and simple, and he complied within one lap. They're rightly so. I think there were a lot of people that were clearly not very happy with that, and
including Leon Camier, judging by his interview at the end of race two,
and especially given the four-wheel debacle that we had the prior week. I think there were a lot of people that kind of associated with that and left a bad taste in their mouth. But he did. And team orders have been around forever. You know, if they're not outlawed, they're going to happen. That is basically the way that it works. James Witham actually had an excellent comparison, because there were, you know, people that are getting upset about it. And he said, well, we can't get upset about this if we didn't get pissed off at David Tardozzi when he let Fabrizio pass Nori last year.
But you see, I didn't get pissed off at Tardozzi. I thought he played that absolutely perfectly, and I thought, no, he's right. This was my point about the Ferrari thing, that, you know, the Constructor Championship, it doesn't matter which order they finish in. The Driver Championship or the Rider Championship should be about that individual on that package. And, yeah, we know luck's going to play a part, but, you know, I don't see any excuse in a proper sport for that kind of manipulation of the results. I don't like it. That's me. But let's not forget, you know, Ferrari, Aprilia. I mean, Machiavelli was an Italian prince. he invented realpolitik. You know, he didn't invent it. He defined it.
I almost feel like I'm talking to you again from last week.
Oh, I'm on my soapbox again.
All right. You know, one thing that I do want to point out, which was really bizarre, was lap one, the hapless Kawasaki's, or the hapless Kawasaki of Roger Lee Hayden got together with Brock Parks, I think halfway through the first lap, and they were out. It was like, boom,
yeah,
done deal. And then later on, I think five laps to go, the other Pedercini with Biaggio went down. And so, yeah, boy, hopefully Kawasaki's got something for next year because they ain't got jack this year.
Mm. No, and
I might get some emails for that one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the much-vaunted wildcard rides, the HM Plant Honda riders, Josh Brooks came 16th, just outside the points, mm-hmm. and Ryuichi Kianari plumb last. Now, apparently, they made some fairly gutsy setup calls that didn't pay off.
Well, they had the big thing, and this was actually kind of an interesting contrasting bit. We know that both Kianari and Ray were in Japan for Suzuki 8 Hours, right?
Yeah.
And Kianari won, or his team won, right? Right.
Yep.
Ray's team came in third with a valiant effort to come back. You guys have already caught all that in the interview. And Johnny got back, and he was fine. He was ready to go. Changing the bikes made no issue to him. But apparently Kianari did not adapt very well coming back. And so it's understandable. But that is a long way back, and that continued a bit into race two as well. Let's give you the top 10 rundown for race one. The big point of this is that Cal and Johnny, basically, it was a Cal and Johnny show, Johnny and Cal, I should say. Some great passes back and forth, and in the end, with about two or three laps to go, Cal got ahead of Johnny and just put the hammer down and stretched out his lead, and there was nothing Johnny could do to catch up to him, and Cal won his first World Superbike race, so good on him. Your top 10, Crutchlow, Ray, Haslam, Fabrizio, Biaggi, and it's good for Leon to finish in front of Biaggi if he wants to have a chance to catch up. He's still got a long ways to go, 70 points at this point, I think. Camier, Cheka, Toslin, Byrne, and Corser. So a fair amount of Brits up there in the top 10 for a British race, and that tradition also continued into race two, which we can move on to now.
Yeah. And basically, the front two did an absolute carbon copy.
Although you have to say that in race two, Cal stalked him.
Yeah.
He stalked him.
He left it longer. Race one, he overtook on lap 12. In race two, it was lap 16.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept his powder dry, didn't he?
Yeah, well, and he hit the nitrous, I think, at that point. It was like, whoa. Yeah. In fact, the last two laps of Cal coming around, I think it was Woodcuts, the last corner.
Yeah.
Impressive. He had the thing way sideways. The back end's drifting out. He's going up over the curb. Right as rain, and no problem, just ripping through there. And that was one of those ones you're like, that was a jaw-dropping corner to watch, because you knew when he did it the first time he was going to do it even harder the second time, and you're sitting there, you know, your mouth hanging wide open, bugs flying in, waiting for him to go around. You're like, oh,
interesting. He's got a wonderfully loose riding style, almost like he's letting the bike move,
mm-hmm.
but he's not trying to keep the bike that smooth. He's happy for the bike to move about underneath him, because he knows that if he's stable, it'll survive. Now, obviously, as we've seen through the season, there's been the odd time where it hasn't been. But I'm watching him thinking, his elbows remind me of Ben Spee's, but his style, just, I just look at him, I just think Troy Bayliss. It's that, I'm smooth, the bike can do what it wants, you know. It's almost a sort of reverse of what you normally see with bodies moving around and the bikes being the smooth thing.
It seems like Cal has the capability of going from what is a relatively relaxed position on the bike, though, to what I think of as the Spee's angle, where he'll get himself farther forward and his elbows out, and that's what he did on those last couple of laps in race two. So he's relatively relaxed and tidy and in line, but then when he goes into that mode, it's just over the front of the thing and just way out. It's almost like switching from a superbike mode to a 250 racing mode, which, you know, maybe there's some of that. There could very well be some of that. The last couple laps, it looked like he was riding a 600, not a 1,000. Very impressive and way fun to watch. I do want to mention something about race two. Courser actually had a great start, and he was up in the front group. And coming into turn one, he'd just gotten past Biaggi, right?
Yep.
Just gotten past Biaggi, and he was heading through, and there's a fair amount of ripples in the inside on the apex there that are apparently caused by cars, you know, a lot of downforce and a lot of sideways load. And he hit those, and he did perhaps the slowest front-end wash that I've ever seen. You could see it washing out. And it's when I say slow, he was going about 160. But it was if you could see it from the other side, I can almost guarantee you that he probably ate through 3/4 of an inch on his right knee slider trying to save that thing. Because you could tell it went down, but it didn't go down all the way. And it was still turning to some effect, and the front wheel was not yet skipping like it does when you've lost it. And then eventually, when it was clear that it was going to be done, you could see him essentially push the bike away. He went for a long slide, probably a good 100 yards plus, and the bike didn't tumble, but it was clear he was pissed. He was not happy, which is completely understandable because he had a good run going.
Yeah, absolutely. This was expected to be, you know, a good course or a good track for BMW to show their stuff at, and I think everyone in race one was a bit surprised. Ruben ended up 11th, so nothing too spectacular there. I was really disappointed because Troy Courser had been quite bullish, I think, about his chances. It's a course, it's a circuit he's certainly said he likes before, and he was looking forward to the new changes to it.
Yeah.
So that was quite disappointing. Also, dobbing out, we had Max Neukirchner. He's just not managed to recapture his form from the Suzuki days.
Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see what happens with him next year. Not sure if he's got a contract through next year. I believe he was on a 1-year, and unfortunately, through whatever reason, his results haven't been there. And so he's a great guy.
And he was really unlucky with injuries last year, none of which were his fault, but yeah, it's a brutal world.
It is. Also, Brock Parks, once again.
And Michel Fabrizio.
Okay.
Now, I never saw what happened to Fabrizio in that one.
He pulled off. I don't know if it was mechanical or what. I remember when he pulled off, he took a look at his back tire, but he did not go back out again. And it was clear when he got off his bike that he had no intention of doing it. I've seen him do that before, when he gives an indication that it's his tire, but he doesn't wait to see if they actually throw something on. Maybe they think he's got enough seat time. Maybe they need to conserve something mechanically. I don't know, but I have seen that from before. I remember seeing that at Qatar, not this year, maybe last, where he just kind of pulls in.
He's a interestingly strange rider in terms of consistency, certainly. But out front, we had, as you said, Cal stalking Johnny and dispatching him again. 2-second lead he finished with this one. And again, Johnny was giving it absolutely everything he could and you know, came in a very creditable second, and he looks a lot happier than he did a few meets ago.
Sure. Yeah, I mean,
Leon Camier, 16th to 3rd, his first podium for a while, and the team said to him, apparently, he said that the team said, get involved in race two.
Yes. Well, so we had the issue in race one where he received that sign. They said, go ahead and do what you can, but I bet it was with a caveat that it's okay to pass Max if you feel you can pass Leon.
Yeah.
That's exactly.
Don't get between Max. Yeah.
Exactly. And I bet if he couldn't, I'll bet you dimes and dollars, pence to pounds.
Yep.
That he would have dropped back again. But he did, he created that situation and it did help Biaggi out. And it seemed like he was actually, at a point, was actually making some progress towards the front two, albeit, there was at one point a 5-second gap or something like that. And it was essentially insurmountable, but it was clear that there was something more to be found. And really, if you look at, and as I said in the interview with Johnny, this is a storybook weekend for the Brits. I mean, amazing what you had. You had Albrechts in the top five. It went on down. You have how many in the top ten? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Do we count Crutchlow, Ray, Camier, Haslam, Toseland?
Yeah.
Do we count? Then you got Max.
Do we count Quintoli a little bit?
Well, we've sort of adopted Sylvain because he lives in England. He's married to a girl from Leicestershire. He loves racing here. He likes living here. So yeah, well, I think Sylvain's an honourable or an honorary Englishman. But no, he's French, really, I suppose. And then Shaky Byrne in eighth. That's interesting. He was the top Ducati.
I know.
You got Smertz on. He came in ninth on the Aprilia. Carlos Checa, 10th on the next Ducati. And it's possibly worth mentioning 14th in race one, 13th in race two, Norrie Hager. And I don't think anyone can really explain, probably including Norrie, what exactly has gone wrong.
Yeah, well, I think Norrie knows, and he's been fairly candid about what's going on in his head, or at least what he's willing to tell people what's going on in his head. But there is a suspicion in my mind that this may be his last season.
Yeah, and it's strange that I don't think anybody could look at him with anything other than he will become the Stirling Moss of World Superbikes. I don't know, Stirling Moss is a name that's particularly well known in America, but he was a Formula One driver and often quoted or often described as the best driver who never won the World Championship. He's a old man now. He raced against people like Fangio in the 50s and 60s. But Norrie is just, I almost want him to retire.
I kind of do too.
I don't want him to see a decline or him push himself beyond what he feels safe with and hurting himself. What a total gentleman, really tough competitor, but such an obviously nice guy.
Yeah, you know what, Martin? I kind of want to see him retire, but I don't want to see him out of the paddock. I'd love to see him somehow in a big way be involved with the team at the top level. I think that would be cool. I think that would be cool. I think it's very selfish on our parts to want him to retire because it's really clearly it's nothing that we would have any control over. But I don't necessarily want him to retire. I think it might be best for him. Anyway, I could lounge on that one for a long time. We had four guys out in race two. We had a few people that did reappear. Kinari had a little bit of a better run. Hayden managed to finish. Tom Sykes had looked promising a couple of times in both races, but never quite got it together and kind of hung out with Norrie during that one. In between those races, though, those were race one and two for World Superbike, we had a World Supersport race.
Oh, and man, wasn't it good?
It never fails to amuse and excite, but this was just a classic World Supersport battle, and the race did not start out well. We went into turn one with Eugene got basically the whole shot, or the long turn one, if you will. coming around behind him and actually attempting to go a little bit to the inside in a classic World Supersport mad scramble at the front. Juan Los Scores caught Eugene's rear tire with his front tire, which caused him to go down the very front and middle of the pack. And he was very quickly followed up by one – why is his name eluding me? That never happens.
Tamburini.
Tamburini, who essentially did an endo both over – an endo means basically doing a, you know, a stoppy or whatever – both yeah. over and on top of Juan Scores' tumbling body on the track, and then over his bike, and Tamburini ended up impacting the wall at a rather oblique angle, the bare wall, mind you.
Yeah.
It was just all around ugly. It was, and I think everybody was holding their collective breaths.
And then, of course, Tamburini's bike exploded. So
it burst into flames. So not at all fun. Immediate red flag, very wise by the marshals. And we had, you know, everybody else goes back to their garages. People are watching on TV. And you can see the concern and fear in their eyes for the guys. It was a very ugly accident. We did, however, a short time later, see at least the scores loaded into the ambulance, and he was sitting up, and it was like, wow, okay, that's a good sign. They did take them to Clinica Mobile. At first, it sounded like their injuries were not bad at all. We did later find out after they went to the hospital that I believe it was a broken shoulder for Tamburini and a bunch of bruising. Lascores took it a little bit worse. He had 4 broken ribs, a broken collarbone, a potential cracked vertebra, though I think that might have been from a previous incident, and clearly sore all over, which frankly sucks because he was right there in the championship running, and it's just a two-horse battle now. But what a two-horse battle we ended up with. So anyway, get better, Juan Tamburini. Look forward to having you back as soon as possible. But we did end up with a race.
Yeah, it was just absolutely brilliant. Initially, we had Keenan had a pretty bad start and struggled, and we had Eugene and Gino Rea.
And Harms. And Davies.
Oh, and yeah, and Robin Harms.
Yeah.
And Chaz. And they were pretty tight for a while. Then Gino and Eugene managed to pull away from the chasing pack. And Gino Rea has really, really come to the fore this season. He's doing a fantastic job.
Especially considering the lack of experience that he has. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. Yeah.
And people who see his name, he's not related to Johnny Ray. He's from an Italian, British family in London. And the scenes at the end, I mean, he finished third. Hopefully that's not giving too much away, because most people hopefully should know what the result was. And it was just fantastic. It looked like someone winning.
Yeah, winning the world championship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, what a pleasure, though, to see someone just so absolutely delighted.
Well, there's no doubt that the Intermoto Czech team is a bunch of guys that just love to race. Miller, I was just watching them, you know, in the hot pits, watching them in the paddock, and the guys are just, they're cutting up all the time and having a great time. And for them, this was kind of a vindication of a lot of work they put together. So it was really fun to watch.
And it was interesting. As the race went on, Eugene led from lap 1 to 10. But Keenan was coming. He didn't start well, and he slowly picked people off. He picked Gino off, and Gino started at that stage to go a bit backwards. And Keenan was following Eugene pretty close for 3-4 laps after he caught him. And then Eugene quite clearly let him by. I absolutely, totally agree with James Whitham that, no, Keenan didn't get by, Eugene let him by. All right, let's see what you've got. And he sat with him, and you could tell James and Jack were getting a bit nervous. And, you know, I'm not saying they're Eugene fans or they're against Keenan, they're commentators, but you could see that they were saying, come on, you don't leave it to the last lap. but he did.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I tell you what, psychologically, I think Eugene's just done a Rossi on Keenan. Yep. If I'm just behind you, or the way Norrie used to, remember the Troy Bayliss, Troy Corsa, Ben Spee said it, the last person you want just behind you starting the last lap is Norrie Hager, because he's going to have you. It's just whether he can make it stick. And the way Eugene went past at an unexpected point, and then coming into the last left-hander before the two right-handers to the finishing line, defended his line. I thought, he can't possibly stop it. He's drifted so wide to block Keenan's pass, and he did. Mm-hmm. And absolutely brilliant. I was hooting.
Yeah, and your point is very good, because you could tell in the post-race press conference, and frankly in Parc Fermé, and on the podium, that Keenan was pissed.
Yeah.
The man was not happy. He did not want to do that post-race press conference bit, which is kind of funny. Let me tell you people out there, the post-race press conference, when they do their little interviews, there's pretty much like one guy and a camera and a couple of people in there and a bunch of lights in this tiny little room.
Well, that's what it looks like, but it actually is like that.
It actually is like that. If they can find a large enough closet, I suspect that they would do it there. I think a big part of it is quiet. They're searching for a bit of quiet, which is something can be very difficult to get in a press conference. Just imparting a little bit of side knowledge.
It was also mentioned on Eurosport by friend of the show, James Whittam, that Keenan had gone to Gino Reyes' pit.
Oh, yes.
During qualifying, and in front of Gino, and his dad said, "I hate you," and walked out, because apparently he reckoned Gino had been following him. And I thought, well, that's kind of taking Casey's whinges and just really compacting it into a three-word sentence. "I hate you."
Yeah, your voice getting up to high. Actually, I think it was Bernacle that did the imitation. Yeah,
was it? Yeah, it was, wasn't it? Yes, yeah.
I was howling. That was funny. All right, so we know that we had a few people out of this race, and we'll rip through some of the... But anyway, it was fantastic, and it was very enjoyable. And, and there's no doubt that I'm a bit of a Laverty Muppet, so I'm happy to admit it, but it was very fun for me to see that win. Happy for him. Happy for Pippa. I'm not sure who was more nervous, Pippa or Johnny Ray.
And did you hear Pippa?
Oh, I heard.
She said a rude word.
Oh, did she now?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And Jack said, "Oh, Pippa." I thought she also thought she was such a lovely girl.
Well, yeah. You know, in spirit of the moment. So we know they had Tamburini and the scores out. We also had one of the two Lowe's. This was Andrew, I believe, or Andy Lowe's. He went out in the beginning of the second start, and he also fell in the middle of the pack, albeit farther during the back, and tumbled for a long way. Not a good place to crash. And then Jenny Tinmouth, the lone young lady, a real roads racer on the unfortunately named SorryMate.com to Racing Honda. I finally looked that up because I was always wondering for many years, what SorryMate.com was. And so while I was watching the race, I actually went and looked that up, and I realized that it looks like it's a firm that helps fallen riders find litigators to assist them with their recovery of said damages. So,
ambulance chasing lawyers.
I wasn't going to say that. I wasn't going to use that terminology, but
no.
Thank you for taking care of that for me. Anyway,
no, unfortunately, I'm horrified by it, but in full flow over here now, that sort of thing.
So, one other notable that was kind of interesting. Everybody was looking forward to the return of somebody that hasn't been in the paddock nor on a bike in a while, which was Mark Aitchison out of Australia, and he's living in the UK. And apparently he's terribly fit right now because he's working for a push bike dealer and has been doing a lot of training, but that didn't essentially translate very well over to the race, and he actually ended up finishing last on the same lap. But good to see him back, and the championship standings have actually tightened up, and we'll go back to Superbike standings real quick because that's tightened up a little bit too. But it's Keenan Sofuoglu, Eugene Laverty, 17 back. Yoan LeScours, who was a Unless he can pull off, you know, a half a Rossi, he's essentially out of it for this season.
Yeah.
Chaz Davis, who is 62 back from Eugene, and Gino Reyes popped up on the radar now in fifth spot. So we know that we may see Chaz third before the season's out. He'd have to push pretty hard. There's only three races left. And there are three races left for Eugene to pick up 17 points. And there's no doubt that the only way that's really going to happen is if something unfortunate happens to Keenan. And so it does leave an interesting point. And frankly, we're kind of in the same boat right now with the championship standings for World Superbike. We got 60 points back from Leon Haslam from Max Biaggi. And that's with six races left on that side, there's a little bit more leeway, but it is kind of...
Leon's going to have to average 10 points a race
ahead
of Max, and that is a tough call.
Yeah, and same thing with Johnny. He's 70 points back from Leon. So they're all quite spread out, and it's going to be really hard for anybody to pick up a spot, and it kind of looks like, you know, if you had to look at it now and make a guess, you'd have to say Biaggi is going to take another title. The first one in how long?
Well, 250s, wasn't it? Would have been 1997.
That might be a
97, 98.
That might be a record for the space in between world championships and motorcycle races.
Yeah, wasn't it 98? Because Rossi was world champion 250 in 99.
Okay, here's a challenge to the listeners.
Yeah.
Tell us if that gap would or would not be the longest, and give us the top five with world championship gaps in either Premier Series going back, and you can choose any year, although World Superbike obviously has a shorter history, and send that in to us at the contact form on MotoGPOD. Or you can,
Because I'm thinking that might actually be longer than the obvious one.
Don't give it away now. We actually have
not going to say a word
in a while. All right, we've got a fair amount more stuff that we want to talk about. Anyway, fantastic weekend of racing. I had a great time. Clearly, you stayed up too long. You know, I stay up so late at night watching like timing and scoring, and then I get up the next morning and I have to completely avoid the internet because I don't want to be spoiled. I eventually get spoiled anyway because I'm like a junkie. I can't help find out information. I can't read my email. I can't even open a browser. Hey, Leon, how are you doing?
Hello, Jim. You all right?
I'm doing great. Just a few minutes to chat about the weekend and perhaps the rest of the season. Got it?
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, I'm just about to do a chat show in about 10 minutes, but yeah, if you can fit it in there, that'd be cool.
Absolutely. So you had a good pair of races, perhaps not what you wanted, but at least you finished in front of Max in both of them, and that was absolutely key, right?
Yeah, it was kind of frustrating, really. You know, Cal had a really good pace all weekend, but I thought in race one, the package we had was definitely capable of challenging for the win, if not definitely second. And, you know, I got a terrible start. Kind of caught them up a little bit. I was catching them up mid-race. And then the last six laps, I had a gearbox problem. It wouldn't go back to second gear. So the last six laps kind of determined the result for me, which, you know, was frustrating. But at the same time, it was nice to get on the podium again, you know. So a bit of mixed feelings for race one. Race two, I got the start that I wanted. Never changed the setup of the bike, so I felt pretty good. But after five laps, just had no rear traction. Don't know if a difference in temperature or something, but you know, there's a fair few other people suffering with the inconsistency with the tyres that we had, and that was kind of frustrating for me, really, because I went backwards in that race and felt like I was holding a lot of guys up, but I still managed to scrape a fourth out of it. So, you know, good that we beat Max, and you know, good that we got on the podium, but you know, frustrated that it could have been, you know, a lot better.
Yeah, those boys kind of checked out, and well, that was an interesting part of the race. There was a little bit of drama back with you and the Aprilias, you know, that race one, they wouldn't let Leon run past Max, which in a way kind of worked in your favor because in race two, he came past you and knocked you back to Max. So
Yeah, you know, obviously Leon come past in race two and, you know, he kind of took the podium place away from me, but, you know, the grip that he had in race two was quite impressive, and from where he come from in off the grid, you know, he had a fantastic race. But, yeah, you know, like I say, I'm not too disappointed with the results, but at the same time, it's a bit frustrated that, like I say, it could have been a lot better.
Yeah. So We've got six races left, and you've got a pretty tall climb if you want to chase down Max. But at this point, frankly, anything can happen. And last year you had okay results at Nürburgring. I mean, but a couple of sixths or a sixth and a fifth. But that was on the sticky bike near the end of its development cycle. Better thoughts for this year?
Yeah, no, I actually really enjoyed Germany. I clicked with the place straight away and qualified, I think, on the front row. So, you know, I was actually quite enjoying the race. Race one in Germany last year, I got T-burned off the track by Johnny and I had to come through the field. And race two, Ben put me across the grass speeds when he passed me for third place. So in both races, I felt pretty comfortable for podium positions. You know, like I say, and that was a time when we were struggling with the bike. So and from my point of view, I do enjoy Germany. We've all tested at Imola and, you know, I was quickest after day one there. And Manicor, you know, we had two-fifths there last year, again, on the sticky bike. So, you know, all in all, I'm looking forward to the last three tracks. And, you know, it's only going to take a bit of misfortune for Max. And, you know, that gap can easily close pretty fast, you know.
No doubt, no doubt. And so you've been around Silverstone, but just kind of in a surreptitious way with your dad's school. Actually getting out there and running it at full race pace on your bike, what are your thoughts on it now at this point?
Yeah, obviously, I'd actually not been on the track at all. I was allowed to do half a lap for a PR day, and that's all I'd done before I'd raced there. I did the school the day after the race, which was yesterday, and that was pretty cool to go around on a standard bike as well as obviously the race bikes. But you know, Silverstone is a track for racing. I think it's fantastic, you know, that the fast and flowing high-speed corners, you know, it really makes it enjoyable to ride with a lot of passing opportunities. So, you know, from that side of things, it's quite good.
Okay. Well, I know that you've got a chat show coming up, and I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I did want to give you a call and check in. Best of luck at the ring. Enjoy your break here. You got any big plans?
Not much, really. Just kind of being at home. So, you know, I've not been at home for too much, and we're actually going up to Dougie Lampkin's place on Thursday with quite a few other riders and racers having a day on the trials bike and you know, a little bit of fun, really, just kind of staying at home.
Okay. All right. Well, as I always tell all of you guys, be careful when you get in the dirt, man. You know what can happen.
That's it, yeah.
All right.
That's all good. I'm actually, the only other thing that I'm doing at the end of the year is Mete. I know there's quite a few Americans coming over, Bostrom Brothers and a few other people, so I'm looking forward to that after Magnacor as well. Supermoto, that is.
That should be big fun. All right, brother. Have a good time, and we'll be looking forward to see what you can do at the ring.
No problem. Catch you later.
Cheers. On to some MotoGP news. Ben Spee's visor problem, which some of you have heard about at Laguna Seca, according to GP Week, it apparently occurred also during practice prior. So it's a little strange that a solution hasn't been found. Now, Ben has been with the same helmet company for many, many years, going all the way back, I believe, to his novice career. It isn't one that is super popular within the top-tier paddock, but they have treated him well over the years, and I suspect that they will find a solution. But that is, as you said, kind of a whoops.
Yeah, I mean, to have had it in practice and then not have found a solution by the time they got to race just struck me as, you know, surprising.
Yeah, stuff happens all the time that doesn't get fixed between practice and the race.
Yeah. Wayne Rainey, there's been a fair bit of, obviously, a lot of the journalists been across at Laguna, and Wayne Rainey was there in the Yamaha paddock. He had an interesting take on Rossi's return from injury, saying that, and the relationship with, or the relationship such as it is, with Jorge Lorenzo. And Rainey suggested that it's almost due to Lorenzo's success that Rossi was so motivated to come back as early as he did. Because remember, after the initial injury, he said, "I'm not coming back till I'm 100%. I'm not going to risk it. I have to accept the championship's gone for this year." And yet, maybe it wasn't just sitting there having to watch other people ride bikes round when he should have been there, but it was
well, plus he was on medication when he said that.
Yeah, that's true. but the comment I made there is, aren't Dorna glad that, for whatever the reason was, that he came back?
No doubt. You know, and in fact, you guys should make sure that you go over to www.gpweek.com and take a read of that article. This is a free publication, comes out every week, hence the name. And it's I haven't read it, but Martin has given it the highest recommendation, and I suspect that I will be doing that right after we record this and catch myself up on some info. But
it's very good. You got the it covers Formula One, and to be fair to it, you know, a good half of it is Formula One. About a third of it is MotoGP with bits of World Superbike, and then the remainder is World Rally Championship. But the MotoGP editor and the main writer is Michael Scott, who is a very experienced and highly respected, often confused by novices with Julian Ryder.
Well,
purely because they both have facial hair, I think, and they're both very, very knowledgeable.
Moving along, Valentino Rossi. That's been the news. And in fact, we had a little bit of a false start this week. Who knows if that was real or not? Cycle World blog. Or I don't know if it came from, you know, Gazzetta dello Sport or someplace in Italy. Anyway, somebody said that they talked to Del Torchio, who's the head of Ducati, and he said, we're looking forward to having Hayden and Rossi. And then within hours, there was a rebuttal and refutation of that same story saying, no, this didn't happen. go ahead and go on that, because I want to look something up while you're doing so.
Well, All this was that MotoGP OD's Jules Cisek is currently across in Europe. He will be going to the Brno round, and he did send Jim and I an email saying, anyone particularly want us to interview? And we both wrote back saying, everyone. and we did say, try and get Valentino on Friday night to confirm the move, and MotoGP OD can do a world exclusive. We'll claim one anyway. That's what everyone else seems to do.
So what I was going to say, which is really funny, so that little bit came out from Del Torchio, the denial, et cetera, et cetera. And I laughed because David Emmett at Moto Matters put up this thing, Kropotkin thinks, he's got these little sayings that come up, and it says that the boss can say whatever he wants.
Exactly. And if he chooses that what he said didn't actually happen, then he didn't say it.
Exactly.
But someone was running some stats and saying that Rossi's 18 wins short of Agostini's record of 122 GP wins, or if you believe Ago, 123, because there was a 750cc win he did, didn't he, which he says counts and other people say don't.
Yeah.
So basically that is an entire season's worth of wins. And my thought here was...
There's no way, though, Martin, that if he was going to sign for Ducati, he'd only do it for a year. He'd never sign a one-year contract for Ducati. He would...
No. The point I'm making, though, is that he's 18 wins short. So he's got to win an entire season's worth of wins. He's not going to do that in one season.
Right.
But do we really think with a bike that's not going to be developed that much next year because of the change in CCs, I would wonder what odds would be offered by a bookmaker on whether he does or doesn't make that.
Well, not necessarily by the end of next year, but I can guarantee you if he's in there for a two-year gig, that he'll have a very positive shot at. And there is
still going to win 9 races a year over a two-year period, or 6 a year over. Yeah, that's... you see, personally, I think the move to Ducati, the change in CC, the Rossi's advancing years, and so many hungry, talented young guns, as I've described them, the Lorenzos, the Spees, the Pedrosas, the Stoners, the Simoncellis, the ones we haven't even seen yet, the Marc Marquezes coming up and through. You know, I just wonder if he might fall short. On the other hand, as I said,
I have a question for you. I want you to ponder this for a moment. Who in the paddock is better equipped to go through the transition that we're going to see in the next 2 years?
Oh, Ben Spees.
You think so?
Yeah, because I think
who has changed different types of motorcycles more times in their career? The old man. Is he getting
Loris or Colin?
You know what I mean. The guy that's shooting for the record.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And one thing he's proved time and time again, he's adaptable, yeah. I know. And Valentino normally finds the apparently impossible laughably easy and just does it. And I'm almost certainly going to be wrong. You know, I'd love to see him beat Agostini's record because it just moves the bar higher. And then it's up to someone else to try and do the same. I don't know if we're ever going to see somebody get close to that again.
Yeah, that bar is pretty freaking high.
Absolutely, absolutely. Just going back to World Superbike talking points of... One thing I just wanted to talk about was perceptions. That, you know, we were saying, mentioning earlier about the media and the way they set some people up and they choose who this week's darling is going to be. And the perception seems to be that Cal Crutchlow is having a fantastic year. And I completely agree. I think he's doing very well. And he's really looking like a prospect, whereas James Tozen is struggling. But it was only this weekend's double win that finally put Cal above James in the points. He's 9 points ahead in the championships. And everyone's saying, you know, well, Fabrizio's having a typical Fabrizio year because, yeah, he can be on the podium 1 week and the next week he can crash out or just fade. But, oh, Norrie's having a disaster. And yet Norrie is 17 points ahead of Fabrizio in the championship standings. And I just thought, it's funny when you look at that. Numbers, you know, statistics, lies, damn lies and statistics. But when you look at a championship point, a table, a league table doesn't lie. Some people might be suffering because of an injury, because of bad luck. But, yeah, it's really strange the way that our perceptions are spun by the way people are written about. And I think James Tozen's problem is he was really bigged up by the British motorcycle press when he went to MotoGP, and they almost seem to now be treating him as if they were somehow let down. And, you know, it's a real shame. And the other thing as well about perception is this thing about Pirelli and the control tyre. Leon, in the interview that we've got this week, mentioned he had tyre and grip issues. This is happening, it seems, every week. Someone is saying, well, we tried that tyre, that was fine. Race two, put a new tyre on, exactly the same compound, exactly the same structure, everything, and it was absolutely awful.
Well, you're almost mirroring what Jonathan said in his bit, so I'll stop you there.
He knows an awful lot more about it than I do, yeah.
Well, he was talking about the tyre that they call the banker, which is the one that they know works, and then having to deal with it, the one that didn't. Yeah, fantastic weekend. We've got even more coming up. A little bit of a break right now, at least for World Superbike, and those guys at this point deserve it. And then we move on to Brno. Those of you that are going to be attending Brno, by the way, Jules Cisek will be there. He does intend on having a meetup. I do not know the exact specifics of that at this point. There will be a discussion of that on the Facebook page for MotoGPOD. Take a look there. You can also write into us and ask us for that information if you do not wish to participate in Facebook, and I know there's plenty of you that don't, and I completely understand that. I was one of those until literally about a year ago. And once again, thank you for donations. You can always make those through the Facebook page or send us an email through the contact information, and we can let you know how to do that to either get it to myself to cover the costs of Skype and all the other stuff that we're covering, or you can just do it through, there is a donate link on there, but that ends up going to Bob, and it covers all our back end and stuff, and we're pretty well covered there. So either way, we would once again, unless Martin, you've got anything pressing or super important, because I think we've gone for another long show.
Yeah, the only thing I'd say is anybody UK-based or visiting this weekend, 6th and 7th, 7th and 8th, Saturday and Sunday, I'll be at the Llangollen Motorcycle Show. Sorry, the Llangollen Motorbike Show. It's the motorbike show. It's a brilliant show. You've got all sorts from sports bikes to choppers to, you know, custom bikes. And I'm attending with Sharon. We'll be on the Wales Air Ambulance stall. If we're not there, we've just gone to look at the shiny bits of machinery. But we'll be back very shortly.
Look for the ugly bloke with the gorgeous blonde wife. Or soon to be.
That's it. I'll be quite distinctive. Unfortunately, for the PR aspect of the air ambulance, I'll be wearing what looks like a toddler's grow suit. Basically, I'm in a flying suit with a set of wings which say Martin Darlington on them, so you can't really miss me. But if anyone comes along, and I know that, I think Nigel Creasy's hoping to come along. Mm-hmm. The weather is looking good for Saturday, and Sunday's looking dry, if not that sunny. So really hope we, you know, we have a good day. Carl Fogarty's opening the show and doing a couple of talks, so that should be quite good. And the very last thing I'd like to say is, if people do go to www.gpweek.com, do read the full interview with Wayne Maney. It's amazing, absolutely amazing. It's quite emotional and very, very dignified. What a hero.
Indeed, indeed. All right, once again, folks, thank you very much for downloading the show, wherever you get it from. I know there's a billion different places, and we look forward to talking to you next week prior to Brno. We'll catch up on all the information, and I'm sure as we lead into that race that there's going to be an awful lot of speculation and the classic musical chairs that we have in the paddock. So, Martin, with that, thank you for once again for joining me, and we will kind of take a little bit of a breather this weekend and kind of get caught up on things, and then we'll come back to you folks next week with all sorts of information.
Absolutely.
You have yourself a good night, Martin, and we'll talk to you later.
Brilliant. Good night, all.
MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGP OD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGP OD isn't affiliated with any of them. You.